vicinity of Taunton when a group of local militiamen attacked. The English took 26 prisoners, but Weetamoo escaped. Soon after, she attempted to cross the Taunton River. But before she reached Pocasset on the eastern shore, her rickety raft broke apart, and she drowned. A day or two later, her naked body was discovered on the shore of Gardiner's Neck, once the village site of her father, Corbetant. Not knowing who it was, an Englishman cut off the woman's head and sent it on to Taunton. Upon its arrival, the nameless head was placed upon a pole within sight of the Indians taken prisoner just a few days before. Soon enough, the residents of Taunton knew whose head it was. According to Increase Mather, the Pocassets made a most horrid and diabolical lamentation, crying out that it was their queen's head. A few days later, Weetamoo's husband, Quinnipin, was taken captive, and on August 25th, he was executed in Newport. To the north in Boston, the Nipmuc Sagamore John won a pardon when he brought in his former ally, Matunas. On July 27th, the English looked on as Sagamore John and his men tied Matunas to a tree on Boston Common and shot him to death. A month later, Sagamore Sam and several other Nipmuc sachems who had been tricked into surrendering were also executed on the common. By that time, Totosan, the destroyer of Dartmouth and Clark's garrison, was dead. An old Indian woman later reported that after the sachem's 8-year-old son succumbed to disease, Totosan's heart became as a stone within him and he died. The woman threw some brush and leaves over Totosan's body and surrendered herself to the authorities in Sandwich, where she too became ill and followed her sachem to the grave. In terms of the percentage of population killed, the English had suffered casualties that are difficult for us to comprehend today. During the 45 months of World War II, the United States lost just under 1% of its adult male population. During the Civil War, the casualty rate was somewhere between 4 and 5%. During the 14 months of King Philip's War, Plymouth Colony lost close to 8% of its men. But the English losses appear almost inconsequential when compared to those of the Indians. Of a total native population of approximately 20,000, at least 2,000 had been killed in battle or died of their injuries. 3,000 had died of sickness and starvation. 1,000 had been shipped out of the country as slaves, while an estimated 2,000 eventually fled to either the Iroquois to the west or the Abenakis to the north. Overall, the Native American population of southern New England had sustained a loss of somewhere between 60 and 80%. Philip's local squabble with Plymouth Colony had mutated into a region-wide war that, on a percentage basis, had done nearly as much as the plagues of 1616 to 1619 to decimate New England's native population. In the end, the winner of the conflict was determined not by military prowess, but by one side's ability to outlast the other. The colonies had suffered a series of terrible defeats, but they had England to provide them with food, muskets, and ammunition. The Indians had only themselves, and by summer they were without the stores of food and gunpowder required to conduct a war. If Philip had managed to secure the support of the French, it might all have turned out differently. But the sachem's dream of a French-Pokanoket alliance was destroyed when, at New York Governor Andrus's urging, the Mohawks attacked him in late February. The Puritans never admitted it, but it had been Andrus and the Mohawks who had determined the ultimate outcome of King Philip's war. By August, it had become apparent that the fighting was drawing to a close, but as everyone knew, the war would not be over until its instigator, Philip of Mount Hope, had been taken. By Friday, August 11th, most of the English forces that had once been roaming across Plymouth Colony had been disbanded. Only Benjamin Church and his loyal seconnets were still out on patrol. They had just spent the day in Pocasset but had come up with nothing. Church decided that he did not care what the authorities back in Plymouth said. He was going to visit Alice. Church and his men took the ferry to Aquidneck Island. Alice and the boys were now staying at the home of the noted merchant Peleg Sanford in Newport, and Church and half a dozen of his company rode their horses the 8 miles to Sanford's house. When she first glimpsed her husband, Alice was so overcome with surprise that she fainted dead away. By the time she had begun to revive, Church noticed that two horsemen were approaching at great speed. He turned to the members of his company and said, "Those men come with tidings." They proved to be Sanford and Church's old friend, Captain Roger Goulding, the mariner who had saved him more than a year ago during the Pease Field fight. And sure enough, they had news. An Indian had appeared earlier that day at the southern tip of the Mount Hope Peninsula. He reported that he had just fled from Philip, who had killed his brother for proposing that they sue for peace. The Indian was now on Aquidneck Island and willing to lead Church to Philip's camp. Church turned to Alice and smiled ruefully. He and his men had not yet had the chance to unsaddle their horses. His wife, he later wrote, must content herself with a short visit when such game was ahead. Church asked Sanford and Goulding whether they wanted to come along. They readily agreed, and soon they were back on their horses and riding north toward Mount Hope. The deserter was waiting for them at the ferry. He was, according to Church, a fellow of good sense and told his story handsomely. Philip, the Indian reported, was on a little patch of high ground surrounded by a miry swamp at the base of the rocky heights of Mount Hope. The sachem had returned to the symbolic, if not literal, center of his territory, and the disaffected Indian offered to lead Church to him and to help kill him that he might revenge his brother's death. It was after midnight by the time they approached Philip's camp. In addition to Sanford and Goulding, Church had a few of his Plymouth regulars, including Caleb Cook, grandson of the Mayflower passenger Francis Cook, to augment his veteran band of Seconnets. There was also the Pocasset Indian named Alderman, who had left Wetamoo at the beginning of the war and had offered to lead Church to her headquarters soon after the Pease Field fight, a battle in which Church had fought against the very same Seconnets who were now his loyal followers. It was a small company of no more than 24 men, but it epitomized the tangled loyalties of a biracial community that had been ruptured and reconstituted amid the trauma of war. Church assigned Goulding, the man to whom he already owed his life, to lead the group that would fall upon Philip's headquarters. With the Poconoket deserter to guide them, Goulding and his men would creep on their stomachs through the underbrush until they came within sight of the enemy. By that time, Church would have stationed the rest of his men at regular intervals around the periphery of the swamp. Their experience had taught them that the Indians always constructed their shelters so that they were open to the swamp. They also knew that it was, in Church's words, Philip's custom to be foremost in the flight. When Goulding and his men attacked, the sachem would immediately flee into the swamp, and Church and his men would be waiting for him. It was always difficult to distinguish friend from foe in the early morning darkness of a swamp, so Church instructed Goulding and his men to shout at the top of their lungs once the fighting began. The rest of them would fire on only those that should come silently through the swamp. It had come down to just a handful of Philip's toughest and most loyal men. There was the young warrior, who was reputed to have fired the first shot back in June of 1675. He would be one of the first to die that morning. There was also the consummate survivor, Annawan. No one knew exactly how old he was, but he had fought alongside Philip's father, Massasoit, decades before this. It is likely that he had been one of the warriors to carry the dying Alexander on his shoulders back to Mount Hope. For more than a year now, he had been with Philip every step of the way. In just the last month alone, they had covered hundreds of miles as they crisscrossed their homeland, always on the run, because never, it seemed, was Philip willing to fight. Even when his wife and child were about to fall into the clutches of the English, the sachem had fled. When they had fallen asleep that night, their exhaustion had been mixed with more than the usual tension and fear. After the desertion of the brother of the executed warrior, they all knew the English would be coming soon. As day approached, Philip awoke from a dream. They must leave immediately, he told Annawan and the others. In his dream, he had been taken by the English. They had been betrayed. One of the warriors stood up to relieve himself. A musket fired, and the yelling began. As had become a reflex with him, Philip leaped to his feet, threw his powder horn and petunk, a pouch containing bullets, over his shoulder, and with his musket in hand started to run. It would be left to Anawan and the others to gather their belongings and hold the English off for as long as possible. As his sachem disappeared into the murky recesses of the swamp, Anawan shouted after him, "Iyutash! Iyutash! Fight! Fight!" We will never know whether Philip turned back to look at Anawan, but we do know he continued to run. The first crack of the musket took Church by surprise. He thought one of his soldiers' guns might have gone off by accident, but other shots soon followed, and he knew the ambush had begun. In the eastern portion of the swamp stood two men, 25-year-old Caleb Cook and the Pocusset named Alderman. They could see an Indian coming toward them. He was running, they later reported, as fast as he could scamper. He was dressed in only his small breeches and stockings. They waited until he had come within range, and now, confident that he was one of the enemy, Cook pulled the trigger of his musket, but his weapon refused to fire. It was left to Alderman. The Pocusset had an old musket with a large touch hole, which made the weapon less susceptible to the early morning dampness. He pulled the trigger, and the lever holding the flint known as a cock swung forward against the metal frizzen or battery, and the resulting spark dropped down through the touch hole into the firing pan filled with priming powder. The explosion that followed ignited the charge of gunpowder in the musket barrel, hurling two bullets, one of which pierced Philip's rapidly beating heart. He fell face down in the mud with his gun beneath him. The warriors coming up from behind heard the shots and veered off in the opposite direction. Anawan could still be heard shouting, "Iyutash! Iyutash!" Alderman and Cook rushed over to Church and told him that they had just killed Philip. He instructed them to keep the news a secret until the engagement was over. The fighting continued for a few more minutes, but finding a gap in the English line on the west end of the swamp, most of the enemy, now led by Anawan, escaped. Church gathered his men on the rise of land where the Indians' shelter had been built and told them of Philip's death. The army, Indians and English alike, shouted, "Huzzah!" three times. Taking hold of his breeches and stockings, the Sakonnets dragged the sachem's body through the mud and deposited him beside the shelter, a doleful, great, naked, dirty beast, Church remembered. With his men assembled around him and with Philip's mud-smeared body at his feet, Church pronounced his sentence, that for as much as he had caused many an Englishman's body to lie unburied and rot above ground, that not one of his bones should be buried. He called forward a Sakonnet, who had already executed several of the enemy, and ordered him to draw and quarter the body of King Philip. The Sakonnet took up his hatchet, but paused to deliver a brief speech. Philip had been a very great man, he said, and had made many a man afraid of him. But so big as he was, he would now chop his ass for him. Soon the body had been divided into four pieces. One of Philip's hands possessed a distinctive scar caused by an exploded pistol. Church awarded the hand to Alderman, who later placed it in a bottle of rum and made many a penny in the years to come by exhibiting the hand to curious New Englanders. Almost exactly a month earlier, on Thursday, July 18th, the congregation at Plymouth had formally renewed the covenant their forefathers had struck with God more than a half century before in Leiden. "We are," they had vowed, "though descended of a noble vine, yet become the degenerate plant of a strange vine unto God. We have been a proud generation, though we are the sons and daughters of Zion." From that day forward, victory had followed victory, and on Thursday, August 17th, Pastor John Cotton led his congregation in a day of thanksgiving. Soon after the conclusion of public worship that day, Benjamin Church and his men arrived with the preeminent trophy of the war. Philip's head was brought into Plymouth in great triumph, the church record states, he being slain 2 or 3 days before, so that in the day of our praises our eyes saw the salvation of God. The head was placed on one of the palisades of the town's 100-foot square fort, built near where, back in 1623, Miles Standish had placed the head of Wituamat after his victory at Wessagusset. Philip's head would remain a fixture in Plymouth for more than two decades, becoming the town's most famous attraction long before anyone took notice of the hunk of granite known as Plymouth Rock. Philip was dead, but Anuwan, the sachem's chief captain, was still out there. Old as Anuwan was, the colony would not be safe, the governor insisted, until he had been taken. There was yet another well-known warrior still at large, Tuspiquin, the famed black sachem of Nemaskut. Tuspiquin was both a powwow and a sachem, and was, according to the Indians, impervious to bullets. Church was expected to hunt down and kill these two notorious warriors, but he had other ideas. He had recently been contacted by Massachusetts Bay about assisting the colony against the Abenakis in Maine, where fighting still raged. With Tuspiquin and Anuwan at his side, Church believed, he might be able to subdue the hitherto unconquerable Abenakis. On August 29th, he learned that the black sachem was in the region known as Lakenham, about 6 miles west of Plymouth. But after 2 days of searching, he'd only managed to take Tuspiquin's wife and children. He left a message for the sachem with two old Nemaskut women that Tuspiquin should be his captain over his Indians if he proved to be so stout a man as they reported him to be. With luck, Tuspiquin would turn himself in at Plymouth, and Church would have a new native officer. About a week later, word came from Taunton that Anuwan and his men had been seen at Mount Hope. On Thursday, September 7th, Church and just 5 Englishmen, including his trusted lieutenant, Jabez Howland, and 20 Indians, left Plymouth in search of Anuwan. They ranged about Mount Hope for several days and took a large number of Indians near the abandoned English fort. When Lightfoot came up with the idea of using the fort as a temporary prison, Church took some consolation in the fact that this misbegotten structure had finally been put to good use. One of the captive Indians reported that his father and a girl had just come from Anuwan's headquarters. The old man and the girl were hidden in a nearby swamp, and the captive offered to take Church to them. Leaving Howland and most of the company with the prisoners, Church and a handful of men went in search of the prisoner's father. That afternoon they found the old man and the girl, each of whom was carrying a basket of provisions. They reported that Anuwan and about 50 to 60 men were lodged in Squanaconk's swamp several miles to the north between Taunton and Rehoboth. If they left immediately, they could be there by sundown. Church was in a quandary as to what to do next. He had only 6 men with him. Anuwan had a reputation as one of Philip's fiercest warriors, and the Indians said that he had let it be known that he would never be taken alive. What's more, his men were resolute fellows and some of Philip's chief soldiers. To take them on with just 6 men was madness. But Church might never have this good a chance again. As he knew from experience, Anuwan was exceedingly difficult to track down. He changed his camp every night and was, in Church's words, a very subtle man. If they left immediately, the old man and the girl could take them directly to the warrior. If they waited until tomorrow, he would be gone. Church asked his men if they were willing to give Anuwan a visit. Most of them assented, but one of the Sakonnets pointed out that it would be a pity that after all the great things Church had done, he should throw away his life at last. In the end, however, Church believed the Lord was on his side. He had no doubt, he told his men, that if they would cheerfully go with him, the same almighty providence that had hitherto protected and befriended them would do so still. In one voice, the Sakonnets said, "We will go." Church then turned to the only Englishman in the company, Caleb Cook, and asked what he thought. "Sir," Cook replied, "I am never afraid of going anywhere when you are with me." And so, with the elderly Indian captive and the girl leading the way, they left for Anuwan's encampment. The two guides walked so briskly over the swampy ground that Church and the rest of the company had difficulty keeping up. The old man insisted that since Church had given him his life, he had no choice but to serve him, and if Church's plan was to work, they needed to get there as swiftly as possible. They had been traveling for several hours when their guides suddenly stopped and sat down.